25:14-18. Matthew 25:14-18. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one who gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money.
Good morning. I did want to add one announcement that it's in the bulletin, but just in case you happen to overlook it, we do have the kids that we help out for Christmas gifts and things like that on our Christmas tree in my office. The reason I mention that is that there's a time-sensitive issue there. They need to have the presents back unwrapped. If you take one of those, I believe, by the 8th, 3rd, by whatever day's in the bulletin, by the 3rd of December. And so some of you may want to be doing some shopping over the break or Black Friday or whatever it is. So if you want to grab one of those on your way out today, those are in my office. Just make sure you write down which one you take on the little clipboard in front of the tree, and we'll make sure that that gets where it needs to be. We're continuing our series today out of the book of Matthew. We're nearing the end of it, but not quite there. Matthew has a few more surprises for us. And we've been looking at what we've called the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth. And the sentiment has been, we've been asking, what is it that Jesus did that makes him so reprehensible and creates this murderous hate in the eyes of the people of his time during that last week of his life, such that they could take a man who elsewhere in the gospel had been fairly likable and ultimately put him to death? What made religious people form a lynch mob and go kill the Messiah? And the reason we ask it in just that way is because we're religious folks, right? I mean, we go to church on Sunday, apparently. And we want to know, are we doing the same kind of thing? Have we misunderstood Jesus in the same way they did? What do I need to see in my own heart when I look at the acts and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and what it is that made him so hated by some? This morning, we're going to continue in Matthew chapter 25, where we left off last week with the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. And that parable emphasized the need to be prepared. Not everybody was ready, but some of them were prepared for the coming of God and his work in this world. The next parable kind of builds on the theme of someone going and someone coming back. That's the idea, this well-known parable of the talents. One of the problems with familiarity when it comes especially to parables is that I've said this before, if you know the joke and you know the punchline, the joke's not as funny, right? Joke is never funnier than it is the first time you hear it. Second time you hear it, well, it's funny, but mostly because you remembered how funny it was the first time. Parables are that way. Parables, if you know the ending and what's happening, then it's kind of easy to get familiar. Oh, yes, I've heard this. Not only I heard this parable before, I've heard this sermon before. And I kind of know what happens with this story. And the parable of the talents is one of those that often kind of gets cobbled together in a certain way, and we know what to expect. I'm going to suggest to you there's a lot more here. There's enough here to make somebody very angry. And it did. In Matthew 25, verses 14 through 15, the story begins, "For it will be like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away." Probably the greatest obstacle, sadly enough, ironically enough, in this parable is the English language and the word talent. So he hands over to them talents, and then in English, the word talent means an ability, which is also a word in the text. And so when we hear the parable, we then preach a sermon about how talented you are, right? Maybe you're a good song leader, or maybe you're a good prayer leader, or maybe you're a good Bible class teacher, and you have so many talents. You're talented. You have abilities. But just notice in the text, that's not what's being done here. He gave them talents depending on their ability. The The talents and the abilities aren't the same thing. The talent is an amount of money. It's an amount of value. This owner has a substantial fortune and property and investments and holdings, and he gives to various stewards a certain amount of that to steward, to look over, to tend to. The word I would emphasize in that verse is not even the word talent. I'd look at the word entrusted. That he has put into their care something that he values deeply. And he has, sure enough, divvied it up based on what he thought they could handle. But all of them are given some amount of the treasure of the master. And it is entrusted to them. What does entrusted mean? Well, the word trust is right in the middle of it. It is put, on the one hand, in one sense, completely in their power. The master says, I'm going to walk away now. I'm not going to be here looking over your shoulder. I'm not going to be watching the security feed to see what you do with it, as if that were an option. He's not going to be checking in on you. He's going to walk away, and then he's going to come back. And during the time he's gone, he has no idea what happens. He trusts you to act as he would with these funds. Entrusted. And so, in a sense, it's entirely in their power. But it's not actually theirs. And that's a point that's going to be very important. It's in their power to act with. They've been entrusted with it, but it's not actually theirs. They don't own anything. What great treasure might we compare this to? Let me get you out of the box just a moment. Instead of thinking about personal abilities and things that you can do, go through your New Testament just a moment and look for the word entrusted. Look for what God has given to his people in trust, to hold in trust. And you almost get one uniform answer. And I did the homework for you. Romans chapter 3 and verse 2, Paul talks about how the Jewish people were entrusted with the oracles of God, the law. In 2 Corinthians 5:19, he says, he is entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. Galatians 2:7, I have been entrusted with the gospel. 1 Thessalonians 2:4, we have been entrusted with the gospel. 1 Timothy 1:11, the gospel with which I have been entrusted. 2 Timothy 2:2, what you have heard, entrust to faithful men. Titus 1:3, his word with which I have been entrusted. Do you catch a theme? When Paul thinks about stewardship, when he thinks about what great treasure God has put in my hands to do something with, he doesn't actually think about natural abilities or even his money or resources. He thinks of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the word that has been handed to him. It's in our hands. We walk around in our time more than any other. We walk around, we literally own a copy of it, which no first century Christian could have ever imagined. The idea of having his own copy would have been incredible. When we have this and it's given into our hands, and we get a lot of say over what we do with it. I write my sermon notes for this morning, and God didn't approve or disapprove in an email when I was done. You understand? I didn't get an email on Friday where God said, Ben, that's not quite what I wanted. Try again. I kind of would like that sometimes because it is the kind of thing that makes you nervous. Am I doing it right? Am I treating this word the way that he wants it treated? But he doesn't do that. He entrusts it and says, handle it right. Do right by it. This is a great treasure put in your hands. What will you do with the message? What will you do with the gospel? Every Christian, whether you're preaching, teaching, or not, has been entrusted with the gospel. The saving story of Jesus Christ meant to change lives, including yours, beginning with yours. And the master goes away and he says, what will you do with it? And I think that's a very fair way to start reading the parable and understanding what goes wrong for one of the people entrusted with that great treasure. Verses 16 through 18, the story continues and we get three success stories. And this is a part of the passage I also think is misread quite a lot. He who had received the five talents went at once and traded with them, and he made five talents more. So also he who had the two talents made two talents more. But he who had received the one talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. I want to point out that these are three success stories. This is not a parable about two men who accomplished their plan and one who just didn't know what he was doing. Three success stories, and here's what I mean. All three men have a plan. The master didn't actually tell any of them what to do, did he? He said, this is in your care. I trust you to take care of it. do something. And he didn't spell it out. All three men came up with a plan. Here's what I'm going to do with it. Two of them had the same plan. I'm going to go down to the market, I'm going to trade it and invest it and do something with it, and I'm going to bring back some gain from it. The third guy had a plan too. I mean, give him some credit for a moment. He thought this through. And he explains his thought process a little later in the parable. We'll get to it in just a moment. He thought the safest thing I could possibly do, this has been entrusted to me. I dare not lose it. This has been put in my care. What would happen if the master came back and I couldn't give it to him? When you say it that way, it doesn't sound at all unreasonable. When you borrow something from somebody, don't you feel an obligation to make sure you can give it back at the end of the day? And so a perfectly reasonable sounding concern, he makes a plan. All three men have a plan. All three men carry out their plan. It's not about two guys who did what they were supposed to do and one guy who didn't do anything. No, he had a plan and he carried it out. He said, what's the safest possible thing I can do to secure these funds? Hole in the ground. That's it. I mean, no one can beat that. X marks the spot and I'll hide the map. I'm going to dig a hole in the ground. I'm going to bury it. It's not going anywhere. At the end of the time when the master comes back, I'll either have it or there's going to be a really rich gopher somewhere. Those are the only options. It will be completely safe. This is practical. He has a plan. All three men carry out their plan. All three men succeed in the sense that all three get exactly what they expected. The first two men thought they could go to the market, the vendors and the money changers, and they could take the funds and invest it and spend it and get back gain, and they did, an appropriate amount of gain. The third man had a plan. What was his plan? To protect the talent against all harm. He carried out his plan. He dug a hole and he buried it. And what did he get? Exactly his plan. Do you understand that from this point of view, so far in the story, we have three success stories. He got exactly what he wanted with that talent. He was going to be able, whenever the master came back, and it didn't even matter whenever the master came back, he was going to be able to say, here it is, down to the penny. Exactly what you gave me, I didn't lose any of it. So I want you to keep that in mind as we move forward, because I think we tend to read this already because we know how the story ends. One guy gets in trouble, so we start reading everything he does through kind of a bad lens of oh, well, this must have been. No, he did exactly what he thought he was supposed to do. In his mind, he did the safe thing. So in verse 19, something happens, which is always what happens in a story. Something happens next that changes everything. Now a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. A long time. And I like that bit. Sometimes in the New Testament, we wonder when we read it, how soon did they expect Jesus to come back? Sometimes it seems like they're expecting him tomorrow. And I think they were ready for that in a sense. But in their minds, they took very seriously the second coming of Christ. And if it was tomorrow, that'd be great with them. They were ready to settle up accounts. But in passages like this, we're reminded that they also had the possibility in mind that it might be longer than expected. To be fair, I think if you had asked any of them, would there be a church in Glenpool, Oklahoma in the year 2017, they would have all laughed at you. Who could have guessed, right? They would have come out like that. But all of them at least had the possibility in mind that it could be a long time. And after a long time, Jesus says, he comes back, and what does he do? He settles accounts. What do you mean settles accounts? What tends to happen when you borrow something for a really long time? I like books. I like my dad's books. And once in a while, I'll borrow one of dad's books. And you know how books do. They kind of sit on your shelf. They look nice on your shelf. I have a Christian Evidences book by J.W. McGarvey. It's green. And I could tell you right where it is on my shelf. And I think it just belongs right there in that spot. And Dad saw it there one day. Said, when are you going to give me my book back? I said, it's my book. It's right there on that shelf. Got it out. Said, it's my book, Property of Frank Williams. Well, that's your book. Okay. I'd had it a long time. I don't even remember borrowing it, which, you know, calls to, I don't remember buying it either. Maybe that should have been a clue. But I don't remember borrowing it. I'd had it a long time. It's still on my shelf. I still haven't given it back. But at some point, you borrow something for a long time, and do you kind of forget that it ever belonged to somebody else? Is it a temptation to start thinking of it as your book? I mean, if you went into my office right now and picked it off the shelf, I wouldn't say, give me my dad's book back. I'd say, give me my book back. Okay? Do you suppose that these fellows might have been tempted over time to forget what was theirs and what was not? That's the great danger of stewardship. It's the great danger of being entrusted with something, is forgetting who it belongs to. And I wonder if he doesn't throw in that little line in the parable to poke at that point. It's not the thrust of the parable overall, but he makes mention of it. It was a long time coming, but when he came back, he did settle accounts. Why does he settle accounts? Because it was still his. On his ledger, that page was still open. They may have forgotten. What did that guy do with the rest of his time? You ever think about this? Now, the first two guys, they're busy in the marketplace. They're buying and selling and trading. The other guy, how long does it take you exactly to dig a hole? He digs a hole, he buries it. He's done on day one. I don't know what he did with the rest of his time. I have no idea. But I suspect he kind of moved on and forgotten about it. But this master comes, and it's time to settle up accounts. And so he does that, beginning in verse 20 through 23. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. All of the servants then start giving account. And I want to emphasize, because I just did a moment ago, the way they word their response. They don't say, Look at my bank account. They start by recognizing that this was never mine to belong with. They say, You gave me this. And with it, I have made these other talents. Now, isn't this interesting? They have the 5-talent man. He's got 5 talents in his trust. He makes 5 talents more. Who do the new 5 talents belong to at this moment? At this moment, he comes to the master and expects to hand it over to him. He doesn't say, here's your original 5 and here's my commission. Here's your original 5 and the profit's mine. You didn't do anything. The man who is entrusted with it recognizes that it was never his to start with. No, part of it belongs to him. All the gain belongs to the master. And his job is simply to give an account that this is fair and just. This isn't even cheating. It's not like the master is getting something he doesn't deserve. That's what the next man will say. That the master is getting what is duly his when he gets every penny, including the profit. The profits were rightfully deserved and expected by the master. God will not ask us what we have done with our goods and our lives at the end of our life. He will ask us what we have done with his goods and his world and his years that he has given to us. It all belongs to him. And the minute we stop remembering what belongs to who, we're going to get very confused about how the accounting goes. And that seems to happen in the next verse. Look at the difference in verse 24 through 25. He also who had received 1 talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. Notice the first thing, it's different. He doesn't believe that the master deserves gain or profit. When the master gets more than he started with, the servant says, Well, that was never really yours. I know you're a hard man. You expect more than you put in. And he's kind of appalled by that. He's frightened by that. What kind of man expects more than he started with? I know you're a hard man. So here, I'm giving you what is yours. What did the other two say? They thought that the five they started with and everything it could have done belonged to the master. This third man believes that all the master deserves is his original investment. And here it is. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, nothing lost. Here it is. I give thee but thine own. And yet when we read this story, we recognize this man is a failure. Why is he a failure? In the practical sense, forget the end of the story for a moment. In a practical sense, what has this man done wrong? He had a plan. It was a safe plan. He acted on that plan. He did it very well. I mean, apparently it was a perfectly good hole. Nobody stole the money. At the end, he gave an account, and down to the penny, he is able to give back to the master everything with which he had been entrusted. Nothing lost. Even Stephen, square. The ledger is balanced. Why is this guy the bad guy? This is the challenge that Jesus is making of us. If you see your life in this kind of zero-sum ledger book, then you have misunderstood everything about it. If you view God as this fearful, dreadful God, whose sole expectation of you is to take what he gives and hide it in the hole in the ground, then you have misunderstood your God. If you think you can bring back the meager substance you begin with, that trust, and say, I didn't lose any of it, we have misunderstood the Lord. His plan, his action, and his success was all conceived of in fear. That's how he describes it. Listen again, verse 24. Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, gathering where you scattered no seed, so I was afraid. Fear. I didn't want to lose anything for you. I didn't want the consequences of risk. Here is everything that you gave me. So listen to the end of the parable, beginning in verse 26. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gathered where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers. And at my coming, I should have received what was mine own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him that has 10 talents. For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have in abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The strange thing about this parable, I think to our eyes, is that the ending does not match the story. The master seems to drastically overreact. Ever send your kids with $5 to go get a Coke at the concession stand? You know how much the concession stand Coke costs, but how much do you expect back, right? If he comes back with the appropriate amount of change, you say, hey, we did pretty good on that one. That's all right. If he comes back with even close to the appropriate amount, if he comes back with any change, if he comes back without 15 suckers under his arm for a quarter each, you think, hey, we did pretty good. And so we look at this master and we say, well, come on. He didn't lose anything. He could have taken that talent and gone and bought himself a boat. He could be out yachting on the Sea of Galilee right now. But he's not. He brought you back what you gave him. And this man is damned to a frightening hell. Do you understand the severity of what looks like a terrible overreaction? But Jesus says, that's the kind of consequences we're playing with here. The man, sadly, who acted out of fear, got exactly what he was afraid of. The severity and judgment of his master. Because he acted in exactly the wrong way. Listen to the three terms that the master uses to describe him. What did the man think he was doing? I was afraid, and so I played it safe. What does the master say? You are wicked. Wicked. That's the word you use for a thief. That's the word you use for a man who keeps the money. I gave it back. But see, the interest was his too. The gain was his too. It never belonged to you, and everything it could have done belonged to the master too, and you kept that. When you decided to act in fear, you robbed your master of what that investment could have done and what he intended it to do. You robbed God. This is one of the old lines from the prophets in the Old Testament. The prophet says, you have robbed God. And the people say, wherein have we robbed God? And he starts and lists off all the good deeds they haven't done. When you hold back the potential for good that God has given you in order to play it safe, God says, you have robbed me of what should have come from my investment. You've held back the interest and fear. He says, slothful. Now, hold on just a minute. Where in this story is this man lazy? Actually, we already noticed it, didn't we? How long does it take to dig a hole? You know, doing something brave is hard work. Taking risks is hard work. Do you know it is easier to play it safe than it is to obey bravely? The master says you were lazy. You convinced yourself, what you told yourself was you were playing it safe, but actually you wanted to dig a hole in the ground and be done with it. And you took a vacation while the master was gone. Day one, get all your work done. I mean, isn't that the way you do it? If you've got 10 things to do over vacation, you get them all done in day one, you've got the rest of the vacation to yourself. And so he gets it all done, he digs his hole, he's finished. The master says, you were lazy. Me leaving was not a time for you to take a vacation. It was a time for you to show that you could be trusted with the work that had been left in your care. He says, you were wicked, you were slothful, and you were worthless. Now hang on, that one's way too low. Worthless. I mean, literally, we can do the math. He's worth exactly one talent. That's not zero. He didn't lose the talent. Isn't he worth that much? The master says no. Why? Because the master already had that. The master already had that. It was already his. When he entrusted that one talent into his care, he wasn't looking for it to be handed back. He could have put it in a bag and taken it with him if that's all he wanted. He wanted something back in gain. The man was actually right. He's a hard man. He wants to reap where he himself did not sow. He wants gain. And it was robbed. It was taken from him. What is the moral of this parable then, with its seemingly strong overreaction at the end? It is a warning to us about the nature of obedience. We too often boil down our religion to the stewardship of the third servant. And we know about this much about God. He's scary. And we don't want to lose anything he's given us. And so we're going to play it safe. We're going to play it safe. We're going to find out what the bare minimum is. I want to know, what does God demand of me? What boxes do I have to check? What hurdle do I have to clear? What's the low bar? What do I absolutely have to do? So that when we get to judgment, I can say, see, that far. Here's your talent. And we expect the Lord our God to be satisfied with that. The crime of Jesus of Nazareth in this parable is in telling us that he's not. That, to put it another way, he taught that our fearful obedience is the same as disobedience. That when we decide that God is so dreadful and so much to be feared that we will try to hit that minimum standard to keep him happy, and why bother with anything else, and that's all he expects of us, when that's the God we see in heaven, it's impossible to even do that. You can't be obedient. That's not obedience. God is not impressed. What God wants is human flourishing. He doesn't want his talent back. He wants it to grow. He doesn't want the person he made. He wants a better one. He wants you in the image of his son. He wants you to mature and become more today than you were yesterday. He wants this beautiful gospel that he has put in your hand to do something in your life, in the life of your family, in the life of every person you know. And he's not going to settle at the end of days for you to come back and hand him a Bible and say, see, I did it. Here's your talent. fearful obedience is disobedience in the teachings of Jesus Christ. He wants you to ask, not what's the least I could get away with this book God has given me. He wants you to say, with the gospel of Jesus Christ, what's the most it could do in my life and in the life of this church? What could we do? If we set aside fear of failure and all the possibilities of ways things could go wrong, if we decided to take that word and the promises of God for all they were worth and see what they could do to make the world better and to make me better and to save humanity, if we dug it up out of the ground and put it to work, what would it do? That's what God wants from us. And the challenging message of this parable is that he will accept nothing less than exactly that. There is a difference between faith and fear. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but it is not the end. Perfect love casts out fear. There is something that's supposed to grow in us, the willingness to go out in the name of that same God and do great things, to pursue excellence in the name of his Son and bring him glory. So today you have a choice. You can be angry at Jesus and say, I was playing it safe and I felt like I was doing pretty good. Or you can listen to the parable of Jesus and say, what can I do with what has been entrusted in my care? And you can be brave. And you can be courageous. And you can expect more of yourself. And you can come to God and say, not just here's the bare minimum you put in my hands, but here is a life that has been spent, that has been exhausted in your service, and nothing less. We're going to offer the gospel invitation if there's anything we can do to help you begin doing that. As we stand and sing, won't you come?